Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This week on Meet in 3, we look at the ways indoor and outdoor spaces are being reconceptualized during the pandemic to better suit new modes of living, working, and eating.
It brought a vibrancy and an energy back to the city streets that were so dearly missed during the height of the pandemic.
This is about how we can grow indoors all year round using proprietary technology that we've developed.
How do I have someone understand, look, don't take a next to the Juneberries because you can eat those. That's free food.
Tune in to Meet in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. Today, we're talking about pie. American pie. And excuse me if I have to take a sweet snack break because I have a real weakness for pie. Well, as you know, the old saying, as American as apple pie, except that's not exactly accurate. But Americans just took it a step or two further. The first recipe for American apple pie appears in print in 1881. And in 1913, American author Henry Finck wrote in his book Food and Flavor, "The apple pie is ours as much as our flag." Finck went on to explain why English apple pies could never match those of American bakers, because we in America have sweeter apples. And it didn't stop with apples. As Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote in the 1880s, "The pie is an English institution that, when planted on American soil, forthwith ran rampant and burst forth into untold variety of genres and species." And indeed, we have pies galore and types of pies galore. What's your favorite pie? It would be hard to choose. But what about pumpkin pie, that iconic dessert of the most American of holidays, Thanksgiving? Why wasn't it as American as pumpkin pie? Well, pumpkin pies were being baked by the British. But we can't claim pies as our own. In many cultures, as far back as the ancient Greeks and Romans, people have a history of some type of dough encasing a filling. And America's just happens to focus on the sweet. It has been said that a good slice of pie transcends Americana cliches. It expresses region and family history. And my guest today knows a thing or two about pies and history, coming from a family who made pie baking their business. She is Petra Petey Paredes. She grew up in a pie baking family. Her parents own the acclaimed Mom's Apple Pie Company in Leesburg, Virginia. She was raised in the bakery and pulled all-nighters before Thanksgiving and learned the tricks of the trade. We'll find out more about that later from her. And learned how to pilot new recipes using produce grown on the family farm. As she became an adult, she decided to move to New York City and teach school. And then she seized the opportunity to open, guess what? Her own pie shop. It's called Petey's Pies in New York City, and it soon became a hit. And now Petra has written a book all about pies, which has become a hit. And it's called Pie for Everyone, published by Abrams. Pies for Everyone was named one of fall's best cookbooks in the New York Times and also one of the best cookbooks by Eater.com. It has more than 80 recipes for the best pies you can make at home. But what interested me even more is that it has interesting stories, background, and history about many of the different pie recipes, and particularly the history of pie itself. So Petra, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Linda. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, you had mentioned in your book that what a couple hippies know about the pie business, and you can tell us firsthand about that. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the pie business.
Yeah, well, by the time I was born, my parents already had an established pie bakery in Herndon, Virginia, near where I grew up. And they had started a few years earlier after a farm operation that they had been working on and planned to continue working on kind of went under after they didn't receive a government loan they had been expecting. And not knowing what else to do, they just sort of thought, what if we sold pies at the farmer's market for a little while. They had my oldest sister and she was a baby at the time, and they needed to make ends meet somehow. And my dad hadn't been a baker in the past, but he was pretty sure that he could sort of work backwards based on what he wanted in a pie. Which is, you know, a nice tender crust and a juicy filling made with really good high quality fruit, and he realized he hadn't seen those in a while. He hadn't seen those kinds of pies in a while, so he figured he would make them himself. So he figured it out. I think he used, you know, maybe some family recipes and tweaked them, and they started making out of their house, selling at the farmer's market, and they became really popular just because my dad had, you know, high standards for himself, and my parents were working side by side at that time in their home. And apparently my mom was really fast. she was really, really quick when it came to the rolling pin and putting a pie together really rapidly. So they managed to do it really efficiently in their home. And the owner of the Reston Farm Market, which was sort of legendary in our town, it told them, you know, you need a brand, you need a name, and they thought it would be funny to call it Mom's Apple Pie Company because it evoked this sort of almost a nostalgic sense and a wholesome, you know, Americana type image of a mom in an apron. And that was very much not what they were.
It's absolutely the perfect name. Yes.
Yeah, it is. And it was sort of a tongue in cheek kind of thing as far as they were concerned, but it did the trick. And then by the time I was little, they had pretty much a pie factory, a gigantic warehouse space with a pie line, a pie assembly line, a really, really cool apple peeling machine. that one was really fun to watch. I daydream of having a space where I can fit the same kind of apple peeling machine in our city bakery. But
So you couldn't stay away for long, huh? You had to open your own business.
It's such a funny thing because, you know, try as you might to sort of break out and individuate and do your own thing, I was just a lot more comfortable and competent in this, like, small mom and pop business setting of having a bakery. And my husband and I met and started dating while I was a teacher. I was a special education teacher in New York for 4 years. But he said that he didn't really know me until we started the business, and we were doing all-nighters in a commercial kitchen to sell pies at a market on the weekends. And he saw me just really in my element, you know, delegating to him, telling him what to do, and just, you know, in complete control of my environment in a way that he had never seen when I was a teacher, and just never quite sure if I was doing things right. It's an incredibly hard job, and I've got to say that I am more comfortable in it, in my element as a baker, so as a pie maker.
The apple pie doesn't fall far from the tree. In other words,
it's true. Well,
now the pies that you bake and are primarily sweet pies, right? Fruit pies and custard pies and things. Do you do any savory pies?
We do some savory pies. Right now we have a chili, like a sort of sweet chili beef pie, and we have a chicken pot pie as well as a cheese and onion pot pie.
Oh, all right. When I said that the history of pies or things baked in a crust, goes back for millennia, I mean, they were not sweet pies. They were generally savory pies. But you wrote a little bit about that in a very nice synopsis in your book. Can you talk a little bit about pies in history, or what we would call a pie, having a crust in history?
Yeah. Our perspective as Americans, I think, is mostly that pies are a sweet dessert.
Mm-hmm.
And yet pies are popular all over the world, especially in Anglophone countries. Wherever the English went, pies sort of became a culinary feature of that place. And there's Australian meat pies, and there's all sorts of English meat pies, and each region might have their specialty. But for us, it became such a sweet dessert oriented dish. And my only explanation for that is that the sugarcane trade and sugarcane plantations were such a feature of the American South, and that all of that easy access to sugar made people extra creative with it, and it became more of a feature of pies in American cuisine,
right?
That would be a dessert, so access to all of these fruits, access to sugar, made our perception of pie very different.
Right.
It's not that their sweet pies hadn't existed before. It's just that there might have been, there's of course plenty of medieval pies that blended savory and sweet ingredients, like the mince pies, where mince pies came from, but yes, all of our bountiful fruits found their way into pies, partly because sugar was such an so much cheaper and easier to access than probably anywhere else in the world.
Well, the crusts that were used in pies and back in history, often called coffins by the English, right?
Pretty morbid. Just,
yeah, right. It was a place to lie your fruit. But the crusts often weren't meant to be eaten. I mean, they were. It was hard as rocks, and flour and water, like a paste.
Yeah.
Really, right?
Well, it was technically edible. It was more of just a vessel for the filling.
Mm-hmm.
And thank goodness those days are over.
And I'm not sure when the crust became more edible. When do you have any idea on that? When, because we know it's all about the crust. Come on.
Yeah. Well, I think it probably happened more gradually over time. When you don't need pies to be something that you stick in a pocket or take on a long journey, then it's going to sort of transform over time. I think it might be difficult to sort of pinpoint an exact time when it might have switched over. But I'm guessing that when the focus is more on providing pies as a dessert, then the goal would be to have a pastry crust that is really, just lovely and delicate to eat.
Right. I mean, and there are, I mean, that's an important point, is that the pies were sold from vendors on streets. When you referred to pocket pies and hand pies. Indeed, they'd have to be very portable and, not like a slice of ooey gooey, fruit juicy pie.
Right.
Have to be it had to be well contained so it wouldn't melt all over everything.
And they were often reused as well. So you would eat the filling out of it and then bake it again.
Wow.
Yeah. Well. So it was technically made of, you know, flour and water and edible ingredients, yet it wasn't really something that you would want to eat.
Yeah. And it's interesting because as it became sort of a very popular dessert and popular food item in America, it was really looked upon as became comfort food. And so much comfort food is now, in this time of the pandemic, you know, people are turning to those foods that make them feel warm and homey. Like you said, your parents' pie company called Mom's Pie Company. I mean,
yeah, right. It's, exactly.
It,
yeah.
It just evokes all that, the warm oven and fire.
Being cared for, being
exactly,
nourished.
Exactly, being cared for. Yeah. Some of the all-time American favorites, definitely, as I spoke about already, the apple pie. You know, it's been mentioned that Americans had such a bounty of eventually, you know, the planting and learning to grow all the different natural produce, berries and things. But the fruit just seemed to be sweeter. It grew sweeter and richer and larger. But pumpkins, they learned about, pumpkin pie, we talk about as, you know, being that iconic, as you say, Thanksgiving dessert. But it would not have been in the first Thanksgiving because they didn't have an oven, number one. But they knew about pumpkins. But pumpkins probably weren't even really used as pumpkin pie became popular. Is that true?
Yeah. Yes, that is true. You know, pumpkins, what is often sold as pumpkins in cans to be used in pumpkin pie.
Shout out to Libby's, right?
Yeah, exactly. Those are made often with Dickinson pumpkins, which are botanically a squash, mm-hmm. You know, much like, you know, neck pumpkins and butternut squash. All of them have a similar, you know, orange, sweet, maybe slightly nutty flesh, but botanically they're squash and not pumpkins, and they can taste more pumpkin-y than pumpkins in a
right.
pumpkin pie. I don't bother to say, you know, to say, oh, by the way, these are made with butternut squash, as if that's a bad thing or a departure from the norm, because it's actually quite normal. And the commercial canned pumpkin that you find is botanically a squash as well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's what we've come to recognize as the pumpkin flavor, but it's a
right.
squash. I
Absolutely.
Mean, if anyone has cooked a small sugar pumpkin, commonly used for pies, or a larger pumpkin, you know that it just doesn't give that smooth as a texture as, let's say, a, you know, a Hubbard or kabocha or even a butternut squash, right?
Right. Yeah, I like to use those red sunshine kabochas as well. And, you know, kabocha just means pumpkin in Japanese, and so it's such a funny thing that where, you know, we have this distinguishing line in our heads, whereas, you know, in another language, in another culture's cuisine, there's not necessarily that distinction.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting. You'd think that pumpkin would be, you know, like the number one favorite pie, but of course, you know, off the top of anyone's head, say what's the favorite American pie? It's obviously. But go ahead.
Yeah. Apple, of course.
Course.
Yeah,
of
apple's
course,
the
right?
classic. Yeah. And I think it deserves that that place at number one. I mean, apple pie is one of the most absolute delightful combination of flavors that I can imagine. My only qualm is when people think it's too boring to be good, because it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be exciting or new or gimmicky. It just has to be made really well. And then when you have a nice slice of warm apple pie that's made really well, it is absolutely life-changing.
Right. Well, you know, we were talking about hand pies and, you know, the pocket pies, the coffin types. But the round pie shape with a sloped sides. I mean, that's pretty much that has been around. That was historically one of the first shapes of pies that there were to come to America. I mean, that's maybe the vessel, because it was the only vessel, baking bowl that was used. But that's been around a long time, right?
Yeah, I haven't done much research into pie making pans, but it is quite a natural shape for it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to contain the filling and it makes itself, you know, amenable to so many different kinds of pies, ones with liquid fillings that need to be baked, you know, custard fillings, chest fillings, as well as fruit pies that you don't want to bubble over too much.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's, you know, they've taken on so many different iterations, slab pies, you know, hand pies we talked about, and
right.
All different kinds of shapes. But you had mentioned earlier mince pies or mincemeat pies, and that's something mincemeat. I mean, that's kind of a combination of savory and sweet, you know, preserving the meats. But people aren't really, that's not a common pie on the American table.
It isn't.
And I think in part, I don't know if you realize, I did some research on it for another project, and mostly, you know, because mincemeat was used to preserve the sweet and the brandy and the sweet meats that were in it, to preserve leftover cuts, sort of lesser cuts of, let's say, the venison or whatever, or the beef, whatever had been butchered. And of course that was not necessary after a certain time. We had refrigeration, so mincemeat was not a popular thing to have to make. But mince, or small chopped up stuff, I mean, I think it's coming back as far as just the fruits, just the,
right.
You know, the chopped up fruits. Do you do any kind of a mince pie?
We do. We do mince pies in a 9-inch, you know, full size, as well as in little tiny tart size.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly by request of English people who frequent our shops.
Uh-huh.
Those are the people who will ask us. And you know, in the beginning, I didn't know really. I knew about mincemeat pie as my dad made it. But when I mentioned meat, a vegetarian English woman who is a frequent customer, she was horrified by that idea. It's lost the you know, it, while that's how it originated, it definitely it lost the meat at some point in England. And so it's a traditional dessert. And it's, you know, it's about the dried fruits and you know, macerated in brandy. And it's sweet, but it's more of like a sort of dark flavor.
Yeah.
It's a deep, dark flavor that I really appreciate.
It's kind of like, it's kind of like a fruitcake in a pie form.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And so that you really have to sort of appreciate those dark flavors. My dad makes both fruitcakes, you know, those very old fashioned, dense, brandy soaked fruitcakes that are just really thick and really, I mean, it's the type of fruitcake that all of those jokes are made out of. They could use as a door stopper because it's so
right.
heavy. But it is, you know, it might be an acquired taste, but I have indeed acquired it by now. I didn't like it when I was little. but yeah, it's similar in that, yes, you can age the filling. You know, as you mentioned, it was meant to, the liquor and everything was meant to preserve the meats. Now that's not necessary. However, you might like to keep it in a jar for a while just to let all of those flavors meld and macerate.
Right.
And it's kind of a fun post-Thanksgiving project to get started on your you know, Christmas mincemeat filling. And I noticed that here in the U.S., it's often called mincemeat whether it contains any meat or not.
Yes.
And so you can find versions with actual meat, like muscle meat or ground beef, Or you can find it with just suet, with just the beef fat, like unrendered beef fat.
Yeah, the suet was a very important part of it, right, for preservation as well.
And they make it with vegetarian suet in England, which is funny. Which is just, of course, shortening. But it has, I think, some starch to sort of give it a texture. Ah. And I think that's so funny to go as far as to make vegetarian suet.
That's interesting. Well, you have written about a lot of pies that are sort of, you know, classic, but maybe have somewhat fallen out of favor. We're going to talk about those. I want you to talk about some of your research into those when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Petra Paradis about pies, American pies. And Petra, we specify American pies because I think when we say American pies, people do conjure up that, you know, bubbling fruit pie, you know, fresh out of the oven. I don't know, just seems that way to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's definitely what I think of.
I had mentioned that we would talk about some of the classic pies that some are still classic, and it's very regional too. What pies are in favor? But there's one in particular that you don't find around much anymore, if you at all, and that's the Nesselrode pie. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Nesselrode pie is such an interesting case of something that almost went extinct and came back, and it's so specific to New York City, and just the outskirts of New York. Nesselrode as a flavor is generally just characterized as a combination of chestnut and rum, whether it be an ice mold or a pudding made with those components, and sometimes, you know, fruits, either dried fruits or cherries that have been macerated in rum are a feature of a Nesselrode pie. And it is possible to find some desserts in Europe that are a Nesselrode flavor. However, Nesselrode pie is so specific to New York. Nesselrode puddings were really popular in the Victorian era, sort of pre-refrigeration, and they would be made in a mold, sort of like a frozen pudding, studded with rum-soaked fruits. And then in the 40s, a woman named Hortense Speyer decided to make Nesselrode into a pie. And she made them out of her brownstone home in uptown Manhattan, and she distributed them to all of the different steakhouses and seafood places in New York. They became immensely popular, so plenty of copycats popped up all over. And by the 60s, they were sort of a diner staple. You could find them
right in
just about anywhere. And that's, I hear from a lot of customers who are young at that time that are looking for a Nesselrode pie. And it's most often that they're looking for a Nesselrode pie during a time of year when we don't make it. We make it for we start at Thanksgiving and go through January. People's connection to this pie is so strong. And that's what is so interesting and notable to me every time a customer will write about it, or somebody will write on behalf of their parent or their grandparent saying, he really wants to try a Nesselrode. He really wants a Nesselrode pie. I've never heard of it. I can't find it anywhere. Like, can you help me? So it's the kind of thing that just makes you want to learn as much as you can about it. By the time the late 60s, 70s came around, it had just disappeared. It had just fallen out of favor
faded
for unknown reasons. Yeah.
But you do have a recipe for it in your book. It may not be the original classic. You said you had trouble finding Harriet Spires' original recipe.
Hortense Spires. I found some old New York Times articles And one thing that's funny is, like, you know, one of those old Nesselrode, it includes almond macaroons and crushed cookies in it. It's hard to tell how she might have defined her Nesselrode pie. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing that, of course, had to be, you know, a staple was chestnuts and rum and cherries. I think that, yes, you know, her version might have had various dried candied fruits, whereas the kind that you might have seen in diners and even in Jell-O advertisements that had a recipe, those were more of almost like a sort of vanilla pudding-y kind of, like a rum vanilla pudding with cherries and chocolate featured in some way.
Right. Well, you mentioned that people, they remember it from when they were a kid or whatever, they're looking for it. It just evokes something in them. I think that's true with any of the pies that are more classic and maybe more regional. And I'm thinking chess pie or buttermilk pies, butterscotch pie. That was always a favorite of mine from many years ago when I was a kid. And you don't see butterscotch pie. Pudding, yes, but not butterscotch pie. Well, basically, it's pudding in a crust, right? A lot of the custard pies sort of, I don't know whether they fell out of fashion or what, or persimmon pudding. I mean, persimmon pudding pie. Well, the persimmon, again, a pudding, you know, those are pies that you don't really see that much around, and you have recipes for all of them.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think persimmons are super fun to cook with, and both persimmon pie and butterscotch pie are things that you see in parts of the Midwest and, like, mm-hmm, Illinois and Indiana, and are more specific to those regions. But persimmon pies have been a feature of American cuisine for quite some time.
Right.
I mean, there are native persimmons here that a few centuries ago they would make in a very similar way to, like, a pumpkin pie. They would, you know, add spices and eggs and dairy and bake it in a crust, or bake it just as a pudding without a crust. I first had a taste of persimmon pudding pie at my grandfather's. He would always invite us to his archaeology society holiday party. And of course all of the people there are interested in history in various capacities. And so one woman brought a persimmon pie, and I thought, ooh, she brought a pudding, and I thought, oh, I've got to make it into a pie. And then I found that, hey, that's already a thing.
Chess pie or buttermilk pie, you mentioned sugar, why Americans really started focusing on sweet pies only. And yes, and the sugar, you know, the sugar industry, for better and for worse, the slave trade ran that. But
yes,
the cane sugar in Chess pie, that is such a staple of the South, it seems to me.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, in addition to, you know, being something that we crave, it's also a good preservative. So Chess pie is sort of like it's interesting because it's decadent, but it's also a kind of food that just kind of appeared out of sort of limited means. And so it's made out of ingredients that that are good keepers. You know, butter doesn't even necessarily need refrigeration. So butter and buttermilk and all of these things that keep much better than the milk itself. So, if you're in, and a lot of people don't realize just the extent to which dairy is naturally somewhat seasonal, and that cows don't produce as much over the winter.
And so these
better preserved versions of dairy find their way into Chess pie. So not everybody uses buttermilk, but I do. So buttermilk and butter and eggs and sugar being the main ingredients are all things that can be, kept for a long time.
And considered very American.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, Chess pie is interesting because there's no one way to make it. And while it's sort of a really specific thing, it's also just so hotly contested, because however your grandma made it is the way to make it, depending on who you ask. And so some people use cornmeal in it. Some people don't. Some people use canned milk or evaporated or I've even seen sweetened condensed, and some people don't. Being that as it is, my version comes from my dad. So my version has cornmeal, it has buttermilk, and in my chocolate chess pie, it has cream as well.
Yeah. Now that was good. That's something I'd never come across before, was the chocolate chess pie. I'm going to try that one out. And you mentioned too, that it was when there was little else around and that was what they had. Well, you think it, the season when there is not fresh fruit, and
absolutely,
that you can still make a pie, right?
That makes
me think of choufly. What about choufly pie
there's
Hoosier pie,
right? I think that there's so many types of pies that can fall under the Chess umbrella. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, they are very interrelated. Vinegar pie, which is, sort of a butter-based pie with vinegar in it, and transparent pie, and buttermilk pie. All of these, to me, fall under the umbrella of Chess, and in that they're sort of like custard pies made with a higher amount of sugar and some alternates version of dairy that isn't just, milk and cream.
Yeah. Well, when you said transparent pie, of course, what came to mind right away, which a take on choufly pies, is, of course, the other iconic American pie, and that's pecan pie.
Mm-hmm. Because I have a picture in my book of the sunshine coming through the pecan pie because it is indeed transparent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and of course, so much of, I mentioned a shout out to Libby's, pumpkin. They were the first to grow the Dickinson pumpkins, I think it was, which was a squash, right? You mentioned that it was a type of squash. And Caro's syrup. Caro's syrup. I mean, that's that recipe that is printed on that jar of Caro's syrup, a bottle of syrup, is still, I think, the preeminent recipe that's used by most people at holiday time for the pecan pie. It's amazing how industry drives so much of the, makes sense, but so much of our culinary habits.
Right. I agree. I mean, one thing that's interesting, you mentioned Libby's, they did both canned milk and canned pumpkin. So,
there you got it.
Yeah, exactly. So, the companies that make these things have an interest in making sure that these dishes are associated really strongly with the holiday. Mm-hmm. So that you can't have that holiday dinner without making your pumpkin pie. And here's the standard recipe to use.
Right.
So that is a really interesting feature.
And then, of course, something that I'm sure you would consider a travesty, and that's for the people who, and it's not a problem, but is then the frozen pie crusts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but we all know that it's all about the pie crusts, and you did something rather special, which makes your pies extra special. Let's talk about your pies and what makes them so special.
I mean, an extraordinary amount of butter.
Works for me. It works
as
for me.
As that. Yeah, it works. It really does work. I mean, I think that, you know, when people think that they are not a pie person, it's usually because, you know, they've had mediocre pie and they haven't had really good pie. And I think that the reason people, you know, they might like to make a pie, but they'll use, you know, a store-bought crust is because it has a very formidable reputation as being a tricky thing to make. I think that it's totally achievable to make it, and my pie crust recipe, as you may have noticed, is pretty different. Not just in the sense that it has a high amount of butter, low amount of liquid. I also think it's really important for people to manage temperatures so that they can make that recipe work. It's really hard to use that much butter and that little water. If everything is sort of getting warm right there in your hands while you're trying to make it. Mm. So I recommend using cold butter and then flour straight from the freezer. And for the liquid, I actually dissolve salt and sugar in hot water and then chill that completely. And I think all of these things help to deter the sort of strengthening of gluten proteins that can make a pie crust tough. Mm. So, you know, when you try this pie crust when it's warm out of the oven, it's almost like it's been fried from within. It's so shatteringly crisp, and it's really, really delicious.
Okay, I might have to take that break that I was talking about to get a sweet snack. Okay, you're driving me crazy here. but that it is true. It's really, yes, you have to have great fillings, but if the crust fails, it's just a different kind of dessert. It's all about the crust, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, one thing that you don't see a lot at my pie shop and my cafe is, you know, crust left on the plate. The crust is just as good as any other part of the pie. Although I do have a 5-year-old who says she just likes the filling and not the crust, but she does have a sort of rebellious streak. And, you know, that's her way of asserting her individuality.
Oh, but then she probably would eat a pie crust cookie if you gave it to her.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about the other some of the pies that you bake. Is there one pie or a couple pies that are really your own creations or a specialty of the house?
It's been really fun to experiment over the years. So, you know, while I started with my dad's recipes, everything that I make and sell now is significantly different from my dad's recipes. But one of my favorites is a coffee and cream pie, because I always just loved coffee desserts. I loved coffee ice cream when I was little. That was a special treat that my dad let us get. It's, you know, sort of exotic to me. I was surrounded by desserts at my parents' bakery, but I felt really special if my dad got me some coffee ice cream. So I aim to sort of recreate that flavor in a pie. And so it's sort of like a coffee pudding and even a coffee whipped cream. And it ends up having the sort of flavor that you get out of a Vietnamese iced coffee, that sort of nice, rich dairy and coffee flavor. And another one that was really fun to make was, you know, once I got my Nestle Road recipe down, which, you know, took various attempts to get it right in the eyes of people who remembered it from their childhoods or from their teenage years. I used that similar format to make a pistachio pie. And so it's I'm sort of enamored with that mid-century style of dessert making, where it's very labor intensive. They used a lot of gelatin, which is quite a feature of the time, you know, the gelatin molds and
that's
stuff.
Right, but right. I saw a picture in your book with pistachios, and I thought, oh, so she decided to substitute pistachios for, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was right after the Nesselrode pie or something.
It is, yeah.
But, and let me tell you, the photographs in the book are drool worthy. I mean, they are delicious looking photographs. And so tell me, the person you had photograph the book?
Yeah, Victor Garcon. He is a former barista of ours. He's sort of an all around talented food person, but he loves photographing food and events and just people enjoying themselves. And so he had worked for us in the past just to, you know, get product photos up on our website or on social media. And I knew that I wanted to work with him when I did the book, because he got me and I got him. Uh-huh. And I wanted to work in natural light and in the most natural way possible, I'm a pretty easygoing person, but I realize at this point that I'm like sort of fiercely do it myself. and so I knew that I would need somebody who could sort of go along with that. And it was important for me to capture pie in its natural glory, and that sometimes means broken crust or little cracks and just these little imperfections that to me are signs of something really good to come. You know, yeah. Like if the crust is a little cracked, that means it's tender enough to break, and that it's going to taste and feel really good when you're eating it.
That's a great way to describe a perfect crust, I think. Now, is your shop open during this time?
Yes, we at the beginning of the lockdown phase, when the pandemic hit New York, or in the early stages there, we took a 1 day to reassess. That many of our employees went into quarantine immediately. A few of them continued to come to work, and my husband was working about anywhere from 10 to 18 hours a day, and took maybe a couple days off for like 100 days straight. I was at home a lot of the time with our two young kids, and I was pregnant with our third kid at the time. So it was a very intense time, just as it was for everybody. Everybody mm-hmm. all of a sudden, you know, was going through these major changes. But one thing that that worked in our favor and that I'm extremely grateful for is that we have a highly deliverable product, and that delivery was part of our business model from the beginning. And a lot of people in New York working from home would, get sick of cooking at some point and want to order from us, either for like a special comforting treat, or we ended up making a lot more savory pies during this time. And they've sold more than ever before, because people want just like a nice home-cooked style meal.
Do you deliver outside of New York City or only in New York City?
We deliver within the five boroughs. We've expanded our delivery zone to within 100 miles of New York. It's not cheap, but it's possible to get the pie taken directly to you.
Well, if you can't get it if you can't get it from Petey's Pies, now you can get it from the book and make your own. That's
exactly.
Give me something to do. Petey's Pies is in New York City, and it was you have a website, petespies.com?
petespie.com.
Petey's Pie, okay.
Mm-hmm.
.com. That's P-E-T-E-E-S pie.com. petespie.com. And the book, again, is called Pie for Everyone. And Petra, it is really a terrific book. I read a lot of cookbooks and a lot of pie books because I love pie. And this is really a great book. And I wish you... You don't need to wish you luck. You've already had good luck with it to date. And I think that what you said, if someone says they're not really a pie person, they just haven't found the right pie yet, and they can certainly find it from this book. Thanks so much for sharing all your information with me.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you for asking such fun questions.
All right, and thank you all for listening to another Taste of the Past. And please visit the website of heritageradionetwork.org and keep us going by pressing the beating heart in the upper right-hand corner to donate. We are a listener-supported radio network, and we appreciate all of your help. Thank you.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.